Welcome to the Reader's Roundtable Podcast, presented by Capital Area District Libraries.
This is Jessica Trotter, and I'm joined by Michigan notable author Karen Dion, who is pretty fresh off the announcement of her Barry Award win for Best Novel, announced earlier this month at BoucherCon. Congratulations, Karen, and thank you for stepping in to chat with me.
Thanks, Jessica. I'm super excited, and of course, I'm really happy to be here.
For those few people I haven't told about the book and gushed about the book, could you describe The Marsh King's Daughter for our listeners?
Sure. The Marsh King's Daughter is a dual storyline, so there are two halves to the story. And in one half, it's the story of Helena, who, for the first 12 years of her life, she lives with her mother and father in complete isolation in a cabin on a ridge surrounded by swamp in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, specifically in the Tequamenon River Basin. And during all that time, those 12 years, she never sees anyone except her mother and father, which to some people might sound grim, but Helena loved her life. It's all she knew, for one thing, and she loved hunting and fishing and foraging, and she loved her father. Well, she finds out at the age of 12 the reason they live like that is because her father kidnapped her mother, and she's the product of that crime. Mm-hmm. So that's half the story. In the present-day part of the story, Helena is a young mother of two little girls. She's still living in the Upper Peninsula, south of Grand Marais. She has, however, reinvented herself because there was a lot of notoriety when she and her mother left the Marsh, and she put all of that behind her. And by the way, I'm not giving away too much because that's all
right,
on the first page of the book.
Yes.
Right? So she's reinvented herself. She has a new name. Even her husband does not know mm-hmm. her history. But then her father, who has been in Marquette Prison for 13 years, escapes by killing two guards during a prison transfer, and he disappears into the Seney Wildlife Refuge. So he makes police think. But Helena knows he's much smarter than that.
Right.
She also knows he's coming for her. So now, in the present-day part of the story, Helena has to use the hunting and tracking skills that he taught her as a child mm-hmm. against him to find him before he can find her. So it's this very tense cat-and-mouse game
right.
in the present, interwoven with the story of how she grew up.
And one of the things, it's got so many ways in for our readers. It has that, there's a very popular group of people who just love that survival storyline, that off-the-grid living. There's that disturbing father-daughter relationship. And then there's the literary tie-in to the Hans Christian Andersen storyline as well. Can you talk a little bit about adding that into the story?
Sure. So, a lot of people think that I based The Marsh King's Daughter on the fairy tale, but it actually happened the other way around. I woke up in the middle of the night with the first sentences of The Marsh King's Daughter fully formed in my head. And the sentences are, "If I told you my mother's name, you'd recognize it right away. My mother was famous, though she never wanted to be. Hers wasn't the kind of fame anyone would wish for. J.C. Dugard, Amanda Berry, Elizabeth Smart, that kind of thing, though my mother was none of them." And so in the middle of the night, I thought, well, that sounds like a good idea. So I repeated the sentences over and over so I would remember them in the morning. In the morning, lo and behold, it still sounded like a good idea, which
is not
always
the case,
right?
It's great when that works.
So I wrote up a few paragraphs in the character's voice, basically telling me a little bit more about who she is. And that's now what I think is amazing. That's now the first page of the novel. But at that point, I had the character and I had the setting for the story. As I mentioned, the marshlands of the Tequamenon River Valley in the Upper Peninsula. But I didn't have a story for the character. And in the subsequent days, Helena kept talking to me, and I kept writing little snippets in her voice, such as imagining what it was like for her mother as a teenager to give birth to her in this remote cabin, with the only person to help her is the man who kidnapped her. I mean, that's really horrible. But from Helena's, the child's perspective, you know, I wrote down what she imagined that would have been like. So at that point, she wouldn't be quiet, so I decided, okay, I need to find a story for the character.
Right.
And this is where the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale of the same name, The Marsh King's Daughter, comes in. Because I have loved fairy tales since I was little, the darker
right.
the better.
Right.
And also, I love books that offer a modern take or a twist on a fairy tale. Awen Ivey's The Snow Child is one that does that.
Yes, that's a well-loved one for us.
And it's a beautiful book. If your readers... listeners haven't read it, they absolutely must. It was her first novel, and it was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, so I
right.
mean, you know it's
exactly.
good.
Right.
Well, Awen and I also share an agent, a literary agent, so that's how come I was, you know, aware of that format. So I took my childhood books of fairy tales off the shelf and I started paging through them. When I found The Marsh King's Daughter, I was just astonished at how perfectly it fit. Because in the fairy tale, the Marsh King's daughter is the daughter of a beautiful Egyptian princess and the evil Marsh King who took her. And of course, my character who came to me in the night is the daughter of an innocent teenager and the man, evil man who took her. Again, in the fairy tale, the Marsh King's daughter takes place in Viking country in the north. And I had set my novel in Michigan's north, yep. Far north. And then, of course, I set my book in a cabin on a ridge surrounded by swamp, and the tale is The Marsh King's Daughter. And the thing that I think really gave the book structure is, again, in the fairy tale, the Marsh King's daughter by day is beautiful like her mother, but she has her father's wicked wild temper. Mm-hmm. And then at night that flips, and she takes on her mother's gentle nature in the guise of a hideous frog. So the fairy tale is all about the struggle of good and evil within us, and which one is going to come to the fore in the end. And that's certainly true of Helena in my novel as well. Mm-hmm. Genetically, she's half her mother and she's exactly. half her father. So how is she going to turn out? What is it going to be? So I used the structure of the fairy tale to structure the story set in the past. And as you mentioned, it's somewhat literary. There are excerpts from the fairy tale mm-hmm. At preceding each chapter set mm-hmm. in the past. And, you know, the language of those fairy tales is just so beautiful and mm-hmm. lush. I couldn't resist including
right.
it.
Right. No, it was, I think I was lucky enough to get an arc of that because I had the great luck of speaking to you, I think, at an event in Okemos at our Schuller's the day after it was released. I think you had an event at Schuller's. It has been a wild year for you, hasn't it?
It's been a crazy year. You know, so many exciting things have happened for the novel. For one thing, we sold translation rights in 25 languages. So
I was looking at covers today. Those are gorgeous.
Yes, the covers are amazing.
If you go to her website, the covers are quite amazing.
Yeah, and most of my foreign publishers bring or send me copies, mm-hmm. multiple copies. Mm-hmm. Why I need 10 copies in Hebrew, I don't know, but, you know. So when I do library events, like I'll be doing tonight at Hazlitt, and then I'll be at St. John's tomorrow and Flint Library on Wednesday, I bring copies of the foreign editions with me. And right. if anyone knows someone that speaks that language, then, you know, I give them the copy. So that's been fun. The Marsh King's Daughter was a bestseller in Germany. Mm-hmm. It was 18 weeks on their bestseller mm-hmm. list there. It was reviewed in the New York Times, which is, yes. you know, for an author, that's a pinnacle. It was a mm-hmm. rave review. There wasn't a sour note in it. And at that time, I only half jokingly said, kill me now, because it's not going to get better than this. But it has.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, the Barry Award, that was so astonishing because all of the other nominees were established New York Times bestselling authors. Mm-hmm. And then here's my little story about this girl who grows up in Michigan. Yeah, thank you. So it's been pretty great.
And I think for me, I kind of came back here and said, okay, A, she's going to be on the Michigan Notable List. I can tell you that right now. There's no way. And this is before I had any kind of insight into that. But I also just really hoped we would get you to come in and to the library just because it was such a great book. And it has been so well received among our patrons.
I'm really happy to hear that. I toured the Upper Peninsula, made two trips up mm-hmm. there this summer, and it was so much fun talking to readers who lived in the area right. where I set the book. And I didn't mention yet, but the reason I set the book in the Upper Peninsula is because I lived in the Upper Peninsula right. for 30 years. I actually homesteaded in the 1970s with my husband and my infant daughter as part of the Back to the Land movement, mm-hmm. which, if people aren't familiar with that, there was a whole movement among young people living in the city who wanted to feel closer to nature. And right. so, you know, you would pack things up and, not knowing what you were doing at all, go live off the land, which, I mean, obviously, because my husband and I moved to the Upper Peninsula, this is not where you grow your own food to the point where you can live off the land. So we had a few missteps, but We lived in a tent that first summer while we built our cabin. Our oldest daughter was 6 weeks old. We carried water from a stream, sampled wild food. So like Helena in the novel, I have eaten cattail heads and milkweed pods. And like Helena's mother, I have washed cloth diapers in a bucket by hand, and it's every bit as nasty as it sounds. So we only lived without running water for a couple of years, and then, you know, we moved to town and had a
sorry
as our
city
family
girl moment.
Grew. I know. But we stayed in the Upper Peninsula for 30. That's what I'm leading to. And because we moved to the Upper Peninsula because we wanted to feel closer to nature, we paid attention. And so I know, you know, just so many things about the natural world and the wildlife and where blueberries grow, mm-hmm. and what time of year to pick them. And, you know, if I see bushes in the winter with no berries on it, I recognize that those are blueberry bushes, for instance, you know, because we, like I say, we paid attention. So I consider The Marsh King's Daughter like my love letter to the Upper Peninsula.
Right.
And it was so much fun for me to write a character who also loves the natural world, mm-hmm. because I could just, you know, go give her the same feelings that I have. Also, there were so many times as I was writing the novel when I would include a detail in the book, and I would think to myself, I never would have found this detail no matter how much research I did. It was something that I just
knew. You just knew.
Because of having lived there. So getting back to, you know, the two tours in the Upper Peninsula, many of the people I talked to thanked me for not only how accurate the book was as far as depicting the physical area, they also thanked me for the respect with which I treated the Upper Peninsula lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And again, that's something that I just knew because I lived there. They also said that they could totally see this story happening in their area. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's actually, it is interesting. This is mid-Michigan, but we have so many people that spend so much of their away time, mm-hmm. up north. Even I was just talking to one of our assistant directors today who was saying, I've kayaked around that area. I've been through those marshes. I have been around that area, and it is so accurate.
Yes, and this is why I love talking to Michigan readers. I've been all over the United States twice, and my UK publisher brought me over to London to do some signings, and my Norwegian publisher brought me over too. And when readers in those countries read the book, all they know about the Upper Peninsula is what I wrote in the book. But again, as you say, when I talk to Michigan readers, they're like, oh, yes, we went here, we did that, I know what this is like. So it's just extra fun to talk to Michigan people.
Okay. I know you need to get over to Hazlitt. So I am going to kind of close out with one more question that we ask a lot of our authors. What are you reading right now? What's exciting you? Do you have time between?
You know, that question almost catches me by surprise because I am on deadline for my next novel, and I'm concentrating on that. Going back a little further, mm-hmm. I really love books. I mentioned Awen Ivey's The Snow Child. I also loved Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad.
Yes.
And Jessamine Ward's books. And so when I read for pleasure, I read up, I call it. I read outside my genre. Mm-hmm. I read Booker Prize winners and National Book Award nominees. I mm-hmm. want to read American Marriage. I haven't read that yet. But the idea being that that would inspire me to write better. So mm-hmm. those are the kinds of books I like.
That's very neat. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This fall, Cattle is hosting some of your favorite crime authors, including J. Reuben Appleman, author of Killjar, and Tobin Buke, author of True Crime Michigan. Details are available at cattle.org/events. Okay, welcome back to Readers Roundtable. This is Jessica Trotter. I'm one of the selectors. I am joined by my fellow selectors, Sherry McConnell and Mari Garza. Thank you, ladies, for joining me on this.
Pleasure to be here.
Hello.
One of the topics we wanted to start with today was it is Banned Books Week starting on September 23rd. And we looked it up, and Mari and I confirmed that Banned Books Week has been going since 1982.
Yep, long time.
It's a week to take notice of those materials that people have challenged for various reasons, whether it's mostly age appropriateness is what the general argument is. So we all have our favorites.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in general, it's, at least for me personally, it's about, you know, the practice of, you know, standing up for voices that are out there that want to silence certain stories mm-hmm. or viewpoints. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like it's really important to call out all forms of censorship and to celebrate reading, whatever the stories are.
And also, it's sort of one of those things where we've talked about this before. As an example of a book, there was all kinds of backlash and discussion when Harry Potter gained popularity, for example. In fact, there was a Michigan incident that came up in the newspaper at a church somewhere wanted their members to destroy copies of Harry Potter. And the interesting thing about that to me, and kind of all attempts at censorship, is that that is exactly the reason I went and picked up the book, and I don't know that I would have picked up Harry Potter necessarily. And it wasn't just me. It was my grandmother, my mother, my aunt, and my cousin all sitting around a table looking at this article and thinking, well, then that's a book we should go pick up and read. Yeah. And I'm so glad we did. I mean, we loved that series. But it's one of those things where it doesn't always... I'm not pro-censorship in any way, but it has a backlash effect.
Yeah.
It tends to make people yeah. want to read all of those books
right.
that people
right. In some about. Ways, I remember when I was studying broadcasting many, many, many years ago, there was some organization out there that would put the whole ratings on the movies.
Right.
And I feel like that sort of got people wanting to go see the movies that had the certain ratings, because it was kind of like an identifier of like, oh, let's go check this out.
Mm-hmm. And in preparing for this podcast, I was looking up, you know, what banned books are there, and there are some well-known classic banned books like mm-hmm. Catcher in the Rye and The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, but I was surprised at some of the titles that I saw, and including some beloved books from not my childhood, but my children's childhood that I read to them over and over and over. One of them is Hop on Pop by Dr. Seuss. And I was actually astonished because I remember many times reading that to my children and how this was something that these were easy words that that's a book they could read to me. And so I was surprised to see it on a challenged books list. And it turned out that there are people who wanted it withdrawn from bookstores or schools because they saw it as encouraging violence. And I mean, that's not the way I take it, and it was an interesting change of perspective for me, mm-hmm. or another way of seeing it. Another beloved book from my children's childhood are the Junie B. Jones books, which mm-hmm. is another surprise to me, because that was another one that was one of my children's first readers,
right.
And they delighted in the antics of Junie B. Jones and all the trouble she got into. And so it definitely, this list made me aware of how other people see these type of books. And for Junie B. Jones, the fun of Junie B. Jones to me and what people objected to was her language. And her behavior, she would get angry and she would say she would hate something. And she would often make poor decisions. And my children thought that was hilarious. And other people may have different perspectives on her behavior. But to me, I just see that as just a typical little kid.
Yeah. One of the books that I was drawn to in the last year or two that I've seen on this list this year is I Am Jazz. It's a picture book biography about Jazz Jennings. And this is the story of a transgender child who kind of traces her childhood, her early childhood, especially talking about what the thoughts that she had going on as a child, feeling like she was in a boy's body, but was having all these feelings and emotions of expression as a girl. And it kind of just highlights her life, all the things that she really enjoyed, but also the incident of going into a doctor's office and having her doctor affirm where she was coming from and helping her parents and later on teachers accept who she is.
And kind of to jump off that, one of the ones that I've read recently, also about a transgender child. And I get that that's a tough subject for a lot of people, but the book I read was George by Alex Gino, and it's written for elementary age children. It's a kind of a beginning chapter book, but this is a Lambda Literary Award winner. It's been challenged because of the content, but it's about a child who you're in their head. They're telling the story, and they've never seen themselves as anything but a girl. That was George's thoughts, and that's the way the book is presented. She tells her story, and it's just it. I think it's an important one for people to get kind of inside the head of somebody going through those issues and trying to get to the point where you can be you in all your glory and it not mm-hmm. be an issue with the rest of the world. Whether you can find, you know, whether you can totally empathize or not, I think it's a really good chance to kind of get another viewpoint, get the viewpoint of a child, transgender child. And for all banned books, it's one of those things where everybody is totally welcome to not read a book where the banned book week and why we highlight these things is it's that belief that everybody has a right to choose what they're going to read and not take that right away from other people.
That's right. That's right. On the website this year, I think it's banbooksweek.org, mm-hmm. They have a really interesting video about, you know, just imagine that you go to the library and you're looking for a subject that someone has decided you shouldn't be reading and you can't find something in your public library or in your school library, or you're right in the middle of having really intense discussions about something, and then your school board or your principal or someone says, you know what, this shouldn't be discussed, and then you're just sort of cut off, and just that just goes so against kind of who we are as a society, and that just that we celebrate the freedom of discussion and expression and mm-hmm. just being able to read whatever you want.
And another title that I am, that's a great point, and that brings me to another title that I was thinking about. Because of the Me Too movement and other things in the news right now, I think people are looking for people that have experienced their struggles.
Shared stories.
And if those shared stories aren't on the shelf for other people to read, then those voices are lost. And they, in those kinds of stories, help other people express their emotions and what has happened to them. A book that I read years ago, just remember that it was express a person's profound experiences, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou. And in it, she describes her rape as a child and sexual abuse and her pregnancy as a teenager. And those are the reasons why the book was banned or taken off reading lists, but that's a reason why it's so important, is for people who are searching for other people with those experiences and searching for language to describe their own experiences, and that's why these kinds of books need to be accessible.
And kind of totally off in a different direction, another book that I have really enjoyed that's on the band, that has been challenged over the years, or it's actually a series, it's Saga by Brian Vaughn. And the interesting thing about this is it is an adult comic. It is sold as an adult comic. It is, I mean, it's clearly labeled as such. I can see where anybody who finds it on a high school shelf might have issues. It does have violence. It does have sexual content. But it's also a really neat story about two groups who've been fighting a war for years and years and years. Two soldiers meet on the battlefield, one with horns and one with wings. And they meet, and they fall in love, and they have a kid. It's sort of, it looks at non-traditional families in that they are, it'd be like the equivalent of, you know, a black person marrying a white person in their, you know, in our earlier phases. I'm hoping we're beyond that now. But it's a mixed marriage. They have a biracial child. All the world is kind of after them. And the weird thing to me is that one of the reasons it was actually challenged, one of the reasons given for it being challenged is it being anti-family. And the whole point of this book is trying to get this family, keep this family alive together and able to just exist and be themselves and express their love. And it's just a wild, weird story. But I'd highly suggest it. But I also will say, I understand it is adult content, but it's never been branded as anything else. Oh. But it's something with people of color. It's something with a strong idea of wanting peace, wanting to be able to end the war, or at least get away from it and live out their lives happily together, no longer fighting.
Wow. So this is Maddie, and the number one challenge book of 2017, according to the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom, is 13 Reasons Why by Jay Asher. I'm sure many in our audience has heard about this book, or at the very least the Netflix series. And I get why people are really maybe afraid of this book in some ways, because it's about a very serious leading cause of death among children and adolescents. Suicide is nothing that anyone ever wants to see in their classroom, their families. And I understand why I wouldn't want to be exposing children to that sort of content, but I think the book itself was just really a very, very great way to start conversation about just the things that affect teenagers and how our actions really do influence others. So in case you don't know, it's basically about 13 teenagers who in one way or another get to hear about how they influenced a fellow classmate to end up taking her life. So, yeah, that's a pretty good one.
And a lot of these stories do have are talking about tough topics, and we get that, but it is one of those things, we need those types of stories to start conversation, to identify things going on in our lives, to, as Sherry said, bring the words that we can't figure out when we want to share our stories. I think it's just something important. So did anybody else want to talk about any other titles?
Well, and I was just going back to an important topic. When I talked about I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and it's, yes, there is sexual violence and sexuality and depictions of racism in this book, but what I felt at the end of the book was this feeling of triumph. Mm-hmm. She, in the ending of the book, is her finding her voice and finding a place in the world. And those stories and those feelings are also lost when we don't have those books on the shelf.
Thank you. Before we close, we also had a kind of a fun experience of being able to kind of to come up with a list of buzzworthy titles for the Lansing State Journal a few weeks ago. So is there anything that you guys wanted to highlight? It was a fun list of 20. One of the ones on my list, I will go light first because I actually have one really heavy title. For any Charlaine Harris fans, fans of True Blood, fans of Midnight Texas series, she's starting a new series that's kind of a vaguely Western dystopian book. It's called An Easy Death, and so that's one that's coming out at the very beginning of October that I think people should keep an eye out for.
Okay, well, this is Sherry, and I guess I have... I'll mention a couple. One that just came out. Actually, I've got three. I hope you guys don't mind.
No, you go ahead.
I'm a fan. The one that just came out is by Doris Kearns Goodwin, and if you're a fan of A Team of Rivals, the big hit of hers about Abraham Lincoln, she just came out with a book called Leadership in Turbulent Times. And she goes back and looks at the four presidents that she has written biographies about, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson, and talks about their styles of leadership and how they became leaders to themselves and to other people. It's just a great look back at her work and also finding words to describe what leadership is. Another one that I'll mention is The Library Book by Susan Orlin. That one's coming out in October 16th, and if you're a fan of the Orchid Thief, she's a New Yorker staff writer, and this one is about the Los Angeles Public Library going up in flames. And a lot of people, including me, missed this huge fire. She said that there were so many other things going on in the news at the time that this library burned that a lot of people missed it, even though hundreds, thousands of books were lost and lots of other important content. And it's a love letter to this particular library and the staff who worked there, and a love letter to the libraries in general. So I'm a fan.
Well, the one that is on my list for this fall is Dry by Neil Schusterman. And if I remember correctly, he wrote this with his son. And it's a YA, or young adult title, sort of dystopian, science fiction-y take on what it means to run out of water. I believe it's set in California. And it's kind of teams of people who end up, you know, having to compete for water access. And I have not read through it fully at all, so I'm really looking forward to actually getting the copy in my hands and finishing that. And the reason why it appeals to me is because we hear so many different stories about water problems and shortages, and you think about other places in the world that don't have access to clean water and to just having times when water doesn't come out of their faucets on a regular basis. And mm-hmm. I think in Michigan, we're really, really blessed with, at least at my house, I usually have water coming out.
We certainly have our problems.
We certainly do have our problems, and it's on my mind because of you know, the problems that are heading closer to home. And so, yeah, that's the one I'm thinking about quite a bit.
There's just one other set that I wanted, because it doesn't happen very often that a fiction and a nonfiction book come out kind of on the same topic. And it's one of those sometimes we encourage our book discussion groups to kind of, you know, think about it from that point of view. Maybe some of your groups read the fiction book, some of your groups read the nonfiction book. But there's a fiction book called Rust and Stardust by T. Greenwood that's a fictionalization of the 1948 kidnapping of Sally Horner, which inspired Nabokov's Lolita. But there's also a book by Sarah Wyman called The Real Lolita, which is a nonfiction look at that same kidnapping. So if you're looking for kind of a whole lot of views on a certain topic, Lolita, The Real Lolita, and Rust and Stardust, there's a group of books that are just kind of coming together right now. They're also reissuing Nabokov's story at the same time, because why would you not when you've got these other two books coming out right now?
Right.
So, anything else today?
Well, I have one more title
that
I want to mention, a new title that just came out on September 18th. This one, again, it's ripped from the headlines. The book is called Rising Out of Hatred, The Awakening of a Former White Nationalist. And it's a biography written with Pulitzer Prize winning author Eli Saslow. And it's about a guy that grew up, he learned to be a white nationalist from his father. He learned that he became very well known in the movement because of that. But the book is about him going out into the world, going off to college, and realizing that there are other views, other ways of seeing things. And the book is about his journey to finding a way out of that indoctrination that he had as a child. I've just started reading the book, and it looks like a really, really good read.
I'm curious about that one. I caught the author, and I don't know his name, but the subject were both on The Daily Show this past week. And that's, if you catch just that short clip, that's that last 15 minutes, it was fascinating. I mean, I think they only each answered one question, but it was fascinating to kind of hear that kind of background and story. All right, thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you interested in learning more about self-publishing? Join us for our Indie Author Day event taking place at Cattle Downtown Lansing, October 13th from 1 to 5. For more information, visit cattle.org/events.